Take a network break. Stock up on virtual donuts so you can avoid tariffs, because I think we're going to get in a trade war with virtual croissants and virtual strudel. And join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. I'm Drew Conry-Murray. Greg Farrow's here. Today's show is sponsored in part by InterOptic. InterOptic offers high-performance, high-quality optics at a fraction of the cost, and you can find out more at interoptic.com. And also check out our new membership site. That's at ignition.packetpushers.net. You can join for free or get access to additional content for $99 a year. All right, Greg, there's not a lot of enterprise IT news this week, but we got a few stories. We'll get there.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, we're in the lull between conferences. We've seen Cisco Live fly past. Juniper's events later in the year. Extreme doesn't have a conference that I know of, and it's a couple of weeks until 6 to 8 weeks before the VMware conference, which we tend to see a lot more enterprise IT announcements then.
A little slowdown for the summer heat.
Yeah, I do feel that this week's been particularly thin. I do wonder, you know, we speculated last week, and I've just finished recording a 20-minute video on the rise of the campus following what we talked about last week. And I just wonder if the vendors are taking a chance to step back and think about where the networking is going and the switch away from data center / cloud to WAN and campus might see us take a bit of a pause as they see what customers want. Mm-hmm. And then check that they're aligned with that. That's just the little voice in the back of my head going, there's like a, you know, like a meta tune going on here that cloud and data center is kind of solved for now.
And there's a quiet pause as they consider what they've done on the campus? Because there's been a lot of campus news in the past few months.
Yeah, well, I think that you've got to remember the vendors don't have magic skills or superpowers about building what customers want. Generally, they build something and then they go to the customers and then it either works or it doesn't work. And 50% of the time it works and 50% of the time it doesn't. So I think what we've seen is all the vendors say, we better be putting something down on the campus. We can't let Cisco get too far ahead with their SD access strategy. And so they're out there talking about that. And so now they'll be out there sending the salespeople out to talk to the customers and saying, well, what is it you really want? And the customers are going, well, we expect you to tell us what we want, which is how it usually works in enterprise IT is, isn't that what we pay you for? And they go, but, well, we don't know what you want. But aren't you the, and the customer sort of goes, aren't you the people who are supposed to know this stuff? You're like the experts, don't you help? And they go like, well, every customer is different, you know, or some such lies. And the weakness, of course, is that they're just scared to make decisions without actually having guaranteed revenue associated with it. And you don't want to be spending, you know, millions and millions and have a product strategy fail. Except, of course, that's exactly what they do about 50% of the time. Yeah, it's pretty normal for any sort of company or big company for to be like that. So I would expect that to be pretty much the normal.
All right. Well, we actually do have a few stories to talk about. And the biggest one, I think, is from our old friend Dell. Dell Technologies is going public again. Woo!
Yeah, so it was a few years back when Dell went private. I think it's been 5 years ago now. They did a massive private equity buyout deal with Silver Lake Partners. Mm-hmm. And we've seen Dell do a number of different things, get rid of a bunch of business units. The big one, of course, is buying EMC to give them a storage business. That storage business, depending on the different stories that you read, I read up on a whole bunch of stories about this. EMC probably hasn't been a huge success for Dell in the sense that they didn't buy EMC as a storage company and suddenly see a big steep rise in sales of EMC storage. And my view has always been that EMC was dying anyway, so getting an exit was good for them. But it gave Dell a scale, right?
It gave Dell a scale. It also gave them VMware, which I think is probably what they really wanted.
And cloud native Pivotal and also RSA. So it did round out the portfolio. I think EMC was probably... the storage business itself was almost, you know, didn't actually have a whole lot of value in it itself. I think like we've seen with Broadcom and its acquisition of Brocade, it's very cash rich. So it generates an awful lot of cash in that storage business unit because those products sell for enormous profit margins on very low costs. Like the actual cost of developing a storage technology is very low these days. Everything's commodity components inside, slaps a lot of excited sales reps and overcompensated executives on top of it. And you get yourself a high value, high profit margin product. But that doesn't mean it's going to survive. I think the public cloud has been undermining the whole storage array business and EMC really hasn't moved far from that sort of a route. So anyway, Dell bought EMC, bumped them up to a company. So Dell sort of talks about it. It has a revenue now of $78 billion a year. And just for comparison, Cisco is doing $48 billion. HPE is doing $30 billion. IBM is $76 billion. So that sort of really gives Dell the sort of revenue scale that it needed to be one of the biggest players, because it was always sort of like a mid-sized player struggling to sort of make the break into the thing. Michael Dell's made several interviews saying that being part of private equity really allowed him to do things with the company that he wouldn't have been able to do if he was listed on the stock exchange. Mm-hmm. So we've sort of seen that happening. I think this is probably a move to cash out, would be my guess. What do you think?
Well, the EMC acquisition saddled the company with a lot of debt. They've still got like around 50, maybe 57 billion in debt still outstanding. So my guess is they're going back out to the public market as a way to raise funds to help maybe clear out some of that debt.
Yeah, I think they have to get rid of some of it. Like for comparison, Cisco is running 25 billion in debt today, long-term debt. So very highly leveraged, you know, like something like 70% of revenue is actually debt. So servicing that debt's going to be substantial. So they'd have to pay that down. They don't have the cash reserves that companies like Cisco and Apple do. So they do need to pay that down and get it back. And if I was a private equity firm, I'd be wanting to get a return back into my portfolio.
That's right.
Although some of the rules around private equity, you know, normally they would spin it in 2 to 3 years maximum because they've got to get that cash back in to go and find the next one. So for Dell to get to 5 years, but then again, a lot of the venture funding or the private equity market is changing. They're moving to much bigger bets. Like, you know, this deal with Dell was enormous. So the way that Dell's coming back into the market is quite unusual here. So when they went private, they left VMware listed on the stock exchange, but they issued a class of share called a tracking stock. It was called DVMT is the ticker name. And what Dell is now doing is they're buying all of those shares because they have a right to do so, because anybody who actually owns those shares only gets a right to get a share dividend. They don't actually have any voting rights. So they can unilaterally make this decision. Doesn't really matter what shareholders want, which I think is quite cute. They're going to pay something like $21 billion to buy all of those shares. And effectively, that will list Dell onto the stock exchange. So it's what would normally be known as a reverse takeover. You go and find a company on the stock exchange that's failing or reaching the end of its natural life. You buy it and then back your company into it and then list on the stock exchange.
That's right. Yeah, they are sort of backing into the market. They don't have to go an IPO. They don't have to do a public offering of shares. They can say, we're just buying all of this tracking stock and now we're calling it Dell Technologies and we're public again.
That's right. Not only do you not have to go through all the IPO process, you also don't have to go through all the costs of hiring banks and, you know, getting placements, and then senior executives are not then put on planes to run around the country
right,
and try and find
shareholders yeah.
to buy all the shares and do a roadshow. Dell's just going to go and buy up all of the existing stocks, then redeclare the shares as Dell's technology stocks, and then release a very small portion of them onto the market for sale. So why would they do that? I think there's a couple of things. I think the company is so large, they can't get a reasonable valuation for the business. And if you read the 10Q, you know, it's pretty clear that they've got an idea of what they value it at, but they're hoping that there's a premium in the market. So if the shareholders, if there are people out there who want to buy the shares at a high price, I imagine Michael Dell and Silver Lake will be pushing the shares into the market, you know, with the shovels and getting their money back. But if they don't, they'll just continue to hold on to them and keep building up the business until such time as it's time for them to exit.
Right.
So to me, it looks like Michael Dell was on TV on CNBC saying it just simplifies the capital structure because the tracking stock was a very weird way and shareholders didn't like it and nobody trusted it. And, you know, so this just puts Dell back into normal business, gets them valued on the share market, lets them be able to tap the market for liquidity if they want. So if they need more money to do buyouts or takeovers and they want to raise 10, 20, 30 billion, they can just go and issue some more shares and see if they can raise money that way. The thing in the back of my mind is I just wonder if this tracking stock was always intended to be this, like if it was a five-year plan.
That tracking stock, when it first came out, I was like, what is that for? And it does seem like this was sort of a, in case of emergency, break glass, pull lever kind of, I guess that's what they were thinking, that this could be a potential way back onto the market.
Yeah, I just wonder if they had a long plan. The tracking stock solved an immediate problem, but there was also a long-term thing there where they could just pull back into the market pretty easily if they wanted to and not have to put up with all the kerfuffle. The interesting thing about avoiding the IPO is they don't get a lot of scrutiny.
Which I'm sure is good for them.
Yeah. So you don't have to, people don't look too careful at the numbers when you're just trading a stock. People take a punt, basically. It's like betting on horses from some people in shareholder land.
Well, they won't get that scrutiny at least for a quarter, but once they have to start reporting results, that's when the magnifying glasses are coming out. So
yeah, but they don't have to go through an IPO and then put up with all of the kerfuffle going backwards and forwards and people getting the wrong story, and then they have to get the PR people out to manage the spin and all that sort of stuff.
They've got a little grace period, yeah.
Yeah, but it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I mean, Dell is now the biggest IT vendor, you know, pretty much about the same size revenue-wise and capital size as IBM. And IBM, of course, is shrinking and Dell's still growing overall. But cloud must be spoiling the fun, I think. So I wonder if Silver Lake wants to get Dell into the market so they can unload some of their shares, get some of that money back in case public cloud continues to take over.
Right. There's also questions about the long-term fate of VMware. VMware, I think Dell owns about 80% of it, but hasn't bought it outright. And it's very clear that VMware doesn't want to be owned by Dell, so they're holding them at arm's length. But there are rumors that at some point down the line, Dell's finally going to pull the trigger and just acquire VMware fully outright. But that has yet to happen.
And it'll be interesting to see how that works out. VMware has, when 5 years ago, it had to be independent because HPE sold it, Cisco sold it, IBM sold it. You know, if it was Dell, then it would be seen as a Dell product and people would make competitive moves to move away from VMware. And of course, OpenStack was out there and the great big hope was that OpenStack would be a replacement for VMware. But 5 years later, OpenStack is still reforming itself and not, it's obviously not a replacement for VMware for now. So if Dell goes to if VMware goes fully inside of Dell, maybe people would just take the philosophical part and say, it's not like there's an alternative and we keep going with it. And then, of course, Dell gets a very big leverage on customers with VMware because their servers, their storage. I mean, VxRail, hyperconverged strategy with VMware is already very strong with Dell, even though VMware, of course, is partnering with HPE and Cisco and all the others for hyperconverged. But at the same time, HPE's got Simplicity for its hyperconverged strategy. It doesn't want to sell vSAN.
Right.
Cisco's got its own storage engine and its own hyperconverged play loosely built around ESX. So it's difficult to know that what would happen. I think Cisco and HPE realize that maybe that's going to happen, and other people who sell the VMware product and say, yeah, 5 years later, the market's different. OpenStack isn't going to replace it in the near future. We just have to live with this and find new ways to compete. And the ways that they're competing is to build their own storage engines, build their own orchestration engines on top of ESX hypervisor, and then also to do multi-cloud. So the orchestration platforms that hook the hyperconverged platforms up to the public cloud, like the Cisco Google relationship and the VMware AWS relationship, sort of signal this cloud partnership thing. And that's the value add, not, you know, who cares about the storage engine, really?
Right. Well, someone does. Storage people.
It's got to work. I mean, just when you look at it, pull back from a bigger picture. When you're up close and looking at that, Ray, yeah, this vSAN does and this storage, Simplicity storage does. But it's really about the orchestration. Can I click a button and a VM get deployed? Can
exactly.
I click a snapshot? Can I take a backup? Yeah, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. What you're really interested in is outcomes and how you get there. You don't need to pay that much attention to it.
No.
Well, we're definitely going to be keeping an eye on the story as it progresses. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot to talk about. Thanks, Dell, for always keeping things interesting, but let's move on. Vodafone, they're a British telecommunications company. They announced that they have completed a live trial in Spain using optical white boxes. Specifically, this is the Facebook-designed Voyager, which combines packet switching and DWDM for optical transport, and it was designed under the auspices of the Telecom Infrastructure Project, or TIP, which is backed by Facebook to bring that sort of white box and disaggregated and low-cost reference architectures to the optical industry.
Mm. So the last few months, I've basically been intimating that there's probably going to be a breakout in the optical. You could see the momentum, and if you read the articles and read the details behind it, there seemed to be some sort of movement toward it, which is what made me presage this sort of event happening. So this picks up on that same thing. It is only a live trial, but it's a completed live trial in Spain. It's an IP optical edge. That is, it's not an optical switch as such. It's not a core optical device. It's an IP optical. So you have some sort of big DWDM ring. And then at the edge of it, that you've got to get from optical into IP. And that is the piece that can be white boxed fairly simply. So the box design or the solution design is really interesting. It's a good read. There's a good article on the Cumulus website and on the Vodafone website, which sort of talks about it extensively. But you're taking a Broadcom ASIC, just same Broadcom ASICs that we all know and are familiar with. Then they go to Celestica over in China to manufacture the box according to some specifications. Then they go to Acacia, who gives you the ROTMs. So the ROTMs slot into the SFPs, and that gives you the optical to interfaces for that. Then Cumulus has run the operating system. So they're Linux-based network operating system. So you've got the IP stuff, and they've extended that obviously to do some management of the SFPs of the Acacia optics. And then the two parts that I haven't seen coming through before is ADVA is the management solution and vendor. So I think they're actually the company that's selling the product to Vodafone. Mm-hmm. And then they're actually choosing a product called Zeta Networks. That's Z-E-E-T-A Networks. And they're a company actually based out of the UK who are doing an orchestration engine on this. So they're like a carrier-grade SDN controller.
Mm, okay.
Small business.
Yeah, I'd not heard of Zeta Networks before.
No, I hadn't heard of them before. But for this particular solution, ADVA looks like the people who are doing the money, orchestrating and putting the bid together. Zeta Networks is the SDN part of the engine. And then you've got Cumulus, Celestica, Broadcom, Acacia coming together to build the TIP project, the Telecom Infrastructure Project, which is a spin-off of the OCP, the Open Compute Project, mm-hmm. sort of, you know, led and produced by Facebook to produce lower cost bandwidth.
That's right.
Yeah, very interesting solution. I think this is quite a big thing.
If I was a straight optics vendor selling optical routers and other gear, I'd be like, ooh, I don't like the way this is going.
Yeah, Cisco and Juniper would be watching this fairly carefully because both of their businesses built on this MPLS at the edge of the optical, and they've been trying to get companies to buy their edge optical gear so that they can map the MPLS over the optical stuff and bring it all together and orchestrate it. And here's a white box solution doing the same thing from a bunch of small companies.
That's right.
Yeah, it's not all small. I mean, Broadcom's not small.
Right.
But the point is they're using the same ASIC that you use for a 40, you know, 32-port 100 gig switch to do optical.
Right. And also demonstrating that we can put together a package of a separate network operating system, a separate orchestration engine, standard hardware, that whole promise of disaggregation where you sort of mix and match and choose the right combination of hardware and software to fit your specific needs. And that's what Vodafone's doing here.
That's right. So we're still seeing this consistent. So even though there is plenty of vendors out there who are running, you know, proprietary, there's any number of press releases crossing my RSS feed talking about, you know, we've just deployed this optical gear from Ciena and all that sort of stuff. There's also vendors doing white box. And I would not want to present the representation that every telco in the world is running white box or running trials and pilots, although that is actually true because they can't afford to spend, you know, 10, 20 million on a white box if it's going to save them $500,000. 500 million in the network rollout. So
right. And we've talked a lot about AT&T experimenting with Barefoot and other white box solutions. It's the telcos who I think are really starting to drive this white box outside of the giant web scalers.
Yeah. And so I think this is that common thread where white box may not be something that you personally are going to buy, but it's still going to have an impact in the situation where it's right. And for me, as I've always said, the answer is just more bandwidth. And this sort of box gives you a way to reduce the price probably by a substantial amount. 50 to 80% would be my guess. Reduce the price of those boxes from very, very, very high prices and that. And if you can get them down much cheaper, you can just start to throw them out, like replace them much faster or move them around a lot quicker. And if you've got an orchestration solution over it, you can move them. You know, everything gets a whole lot easier if you've got a modern architecture. And this idea of stop focusing on the box and focus on the solution via software control is a step down that direction of getting more bandwidth for the same money.
All right, sticking with telcos, you found a story about potentially a theoretical vulnerability on LTE networks.
Yeah, and it's a vulnerability and it's got a name. I find this habit of security people to actually try and find a cool name for their hack and then make a website named after it and create a logo more or less laughable. But, you know, those people have got a lot of ego and not a lot of common sense. If you're interested in this, basically it's an L2 attack. You have to be adjacent to the person. And by manipulating some of the crypto security, you can intercept traffic from phones on the same LTE tower that you're on. And they're hacking a vulnerability in the AES crypto. They didn't do an integrity check, so it's possible to crack it. In practical cases, they actually are quite clear about this on the website. Yes, it could be certainly compromised in the wild. It's quite difficult to compromise just anyone. So you would want to be targeting. So you're probably looking for high-value targets in a certain area. So if I was at somewhere like the G8 conference or whatever, this sort of technology would be really valuable if the LTE base stations weren't updated to a new standard. It's a weakness in the standard or a flaw in the standard. So it's not exactly going to hurt ordinary people. It's not going to be a mass thing. But those of you who are protecting a limited number of people, you'll need to go and read up on this and start thinking about what you can do to reduce the vulnerability.
So that state-sponsored actor or maybe some kind of corporate espionage targeting, yes.
Yeah. At the end of the day, the problem, while there might be a vulnerability in the LTE and therefore you can crack into it and then use the DNS to make websites vulnerable, like to do a spoofing attack and then direct them to a website of your choice, the problem here is DNS is not safe. It's unencrypted. It's in the open. Anybody can spoof a DNS server and you will never know. And then the websites that you then reach to, even if they're SSL encrypted, unless you're using HSTS, where you actually do a certificate validation to say that this certificate I'm being presented is actually the one I'm looking for, you might actually never know. So we have these weaknesses in our protocols, and that ultimately is the vulnerability, I think, not actually that LTE has failed. We have to assume that networks are unsafe and not don't send unencrypted
data. Oh, right, yes. Well, it's called the Alter Attack. We have a link in the show notes if you want to go read up on it. Okay, moving on. Diane Bryant, she was the chief operating officer of Google's cloud business. She resigned her position unexpectedly after less than a year on the job. There is some speculation that she may be angling for the CEO gig at Intel, so recently vacated by Brian Krzanich.
Yeah, there was a big deal when Google Cloud hired Diane Bryant to come over there because Diane Bryant was seen to be the successor or one of the senior people at Intel.
Yeah, she had run Intel's data center business and apparently did a good job there.
Yeah, well, and the data center business, of course, was the bright shining light inside of Intel right the way up until it blew up. They stood, you know, weren't able to ship the 10 nanometer, and Skylake is still the technology, you know, still not being delivered. It must be pretty annoying for Google to go out there and buy a big brand name product like this. Like, people are just products to big companies. But, you know, you buy a big brand name, Naya, and then all of a sudden it doesn't turn out and they walk out the door. It's only 7 months.
Yeah, not even – and it's not just Google. It's Google Cloud, which, you know, Google's running distant third in the big three cloud game. So having a brand name like that step away does – it's probably a little bit of a blow to them.
And it seems weird that she's walked out the door before getting the nod to be in, you know, considered for the Intel CEO position.
Well, who knows? Who knows what back chatter has been going on between her and Intel?
So she was definitely, you know, the speculation is that she was definitely the successor for Brian Krzanich after he was marched out the door, in theory, for fraternizing with a coworker. But really, he was thrown out because Intel hasn't been able to solve its problems to do with new CPUs and so forth and find us and get into mobile. They weren't able to break into mobile telephony at all. And Diane Bryant left because she felt that she couldn't, you know, she needed a challenge. She'd gone as far as she was going to go at Intel. But why leave Google Cloud unless you're confirmed in the Intel role? Why quit and then hope that you're going to get it? There's something going on here.
There's something, and we may be talking about her in a forthcoming episode.
Yes, well, I guess so, because it's either going to be she's left Google Cloud because she doesn't think it's a good fit, you know, in which case, bamming on Google Cloud.
Right.
Or, you know, she wants to get back to Intel, but for some reason she has to leave Google to be available for that. That doesn't sound right. So
we'll see. All right, a quick break to tell you about today's sponsor, Interoptic. Demand from the edge, 5G, and IoT are coming. If you're not doing optics correctly, you're going to pay for it later. Interoptic understands you're going to need a more nimble layer zero, and they support the full range of products you need today and don't yet know what you'll need tomorrow. So stop paying OEM prices for optics and start talking to the optic experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the price. And don't be fooled by lesser optics. The difference between generic, third-party, and brand equivalent optics matters. You can purchase the same, if not better performing optics at a fraction of the cost. And these optics are designed by engineers who truly understand what you need. So it's time to take control of your optics purchase with InterOptic. Go to interoptic.com to learn how they can help you spec the right optics for your network. That's interoptic.com, and thanks InterOptic for being a sponsor.
My favorite topic.
Yeah. optics.
SFP modules and opticals. It really is. right now, it is really a good way to cut money out of your spending. So go up and give them a chance.
All right. The open source software company SUSE, which makes the SUSE Linux distro and offers a variety of cloud services, they're being bought by a Swedish private equity firm called EQT for $2.5 billion.
Yeah, SUSE is not a company everybody knows. Most people know Red Hat, but it's very big in Europe as a Linux distribution. Famously, years ago, it was actually bought by Novell, which was then bought by Attachmate, which was then bought by Microfocus. And, you know, it's one of these companies that sort of bounced around. But I didn't realize it was worth $2.5 billion. One of the things that you hear a lot of people talk about is only Red Hat has been able to monetize the open source movement. And then for SUSE to be, you know, to get $2.5 billion valuation is like, oh, actually, there's another company who's been able to monetize it. Now, Red Hat has a market capitalization of $24 billion, which is 10 times as large.
Right.
But I think it does make the point that there are companies that can make money out of open source maintenance contracts with enterprise customers. So I think that was the first thing that struck me about this, is that there's more than, you know, it's fashionable in the US investment community to only talk about Red Hat as the only company to ever monetize open source. And yet there's companies in Europe that are doing exactly that.
That's right.
The second thing I thought was interesting is Microfocus customers must be very pleased about this, or they should be, because the company is continuing to stumble on after they bought those HPE assets. And what was it, 18 months ago now?
About, yeah, when HPE decided to spin off a bunch of old assets to be a more nimble company, they sold them to Microfocus. Although HPE did take a big share of Microfocus as well.
But 50.1%.
Yep.
So, Yeah, in theory, HPE owns SUSE, in theory, but only at arm's length at best. So Micro Focus has had a bad couple of months. They've issued profit warnings. The CEO quit after failing to get the numbers to turn around, making promises he couldn't deliver. They've got various product problems. They're not able to get the sales up and going. Micro Focus customers will be pleased that this little cash infusion will keep them going for a little bit longer. And those legacy products that Micro Focus acquired from HPE will be around for a few more years if Micro Focus can turn it around.
That's right. And SUSE itself now gets to exist as a standalone company separate from Micro Focus. It'll stand on its own two legs.
Yes. And it'd be interesting to see if the private equity firm can do something with it, free to the constraints of what HPE, what Micro Focus would have done to it. I think it would have just been one of a portfolio and they would have been pressing quite hard on the profit margins there. Be interesting to see how it works out from here.
Yeah. Good for SUSE. All right, moving on. A Chinese court has issued a temporary ban against the retail sale of chips made by U.S. chip manufacturer Micron. A Chinese chip maker, UMC, alleges that patent infringement is going on. Micron says it's complying with the order, but it is going to appeal.
Yeah, this is very interesting because we've seen the U.S.-China trade war. And if you've been following any of that, you'll know that ZTE and China Telecom have all been having problems with getting access to the U.S. markets. And now we're starting to see the reaction on the other side here. So Micron can't now sell its memory chips in China. This is previously after Micron had brought a intellectual property case in a Chinese court about a local vendor stealing
trade secrets. It's the same company that's complaining. It's UMC. Yeah, Micron lodged a complaint against UMC alleging misappropriation of trade secrets. And now UMC is saying, you're violating our patents and you can't sell in China. And I should note that it's only Micron's retail products. China, it seems like the government is taking a fine line here. It's just the retail products. It's not the components for manufacturing, because that would actually end up hurting Chinese businesses. So they're sort of trying to have a cut a fine line here.
Yeah, I think there's a few things here. This is how these types of trade wars actually happen. What happens at the top line starts to have impacts down at the second and third tiers below it. So we start to see the courts have different views and reflect the government, at least in some levels. And this is the sort of thing that can happen, especially in China, where the court system is strongly aligned to the government, or at least that's my perception of it. I believe that to be the case. The courts will now say, well, we can do this sort of thing because there's a trade war between the US and China and that sort of stuff. So it's going to be fairly interesting to see how this works out. The challenge with trade wars is they often have the law of unintended consequences just runs rampant all over the place. And this is just evidence in the technology space of that. This is exactly the sort of thing that will happen. US companies need to sell their components to Chinese manufacturers, but maybe they can't sell their products directly into retail.
That's what this ruling is saying for the time being while Micron approves. Yeah.
So multi-level trade wars happen at multiple levels. There's what's happened in it, at the political level, and then what happens down at the internal process changes as well. And having lived through these trade wars previously, back in the 80s and the 90s, it's not fun. Not fun at all. It's going to be bad for everything. It's going to be bad for the business, actually. It's going to be bad for enterprise IT.
And speaking of trade war, we have an update on ZTE. If you may remember, ZTE essentially had to shut down most of its operations after the U.S. Commerce Department said that American suppliers could not sell parts to ZTE, which effectively shuttered the business. Now they've gotten a slight reprieve that the U.S. Commerce Department issued an authorization for the company to, quote, support existing network or equipment under contracts signed on or before April 15th. That's according to Bloomberg. So ZTE gets a little bit of a lifeline. ZTE itself is also trying to comply with some U.S. commerce rules. So they fired their CEO and a bunch of top executives. They've brought in new folks, supposedly to change the direction of the company to make sure it complies with rules around. It got into trouble because it had violated a ban against trading with Iran. And so it's been spanked by the U.S.
Yeah, it seems extraordinary to say, the whole management's been removed and bring in new ones. I'm not sure what that solves. If that's a U.S. condition to doing business, that I'm not sure if that actually changes anything,
I mean, the CEO they're brought in is from ZTE. So to me, it feels more like sort of an exercise of power in that we're making you jump through these hoops with the notion that you're going to be more careful the next time you think about violating a sanction.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem to be much of a penalty, So the people in charge have been able to walk out the door and you replace them with people from inside the company who were there when the original crimes, breach of the law crimes, whatever has been committed. Okay, well, yay.
Right. Well done. I know. That's right. So meet the new politics. Boss, same as the old boss, yes.
That's right, and it's all politics. And in politics, the goal is to make everybody unhappy. That's a sign that you've managed to reach a compromise that everybody can live with because everybody's unhappy, I think.
Well, speaking of, despite the increasing tensions between the U.S. and China, Chinese authorities recently gave their blessing to chipmaker Marvell. They are trying to acquire Cavium. That's a semiconductor company that makes a variety of processors, including in the networking space. So China has now given its blessing for the deal to go forward. It's expected to close sometime in July, and this is a $6 billion acquisition.
Nowhere near as big as the Qualcomm-Broadcom kerfuffle we covered for a while here. Really much smaller, but they do very much Cavium's been targeting what they call the data center market. And there's some belief that the technology that Marvell has, particularly around ARM CPUs, as well as networking ASICs, could, and NICs and Wi-Fi and a range of other things as well, could actually be very valuable as a takeover target and give Marvell a chance to compete against Broadcom. So getting this to go forward is probably good for us. Chip making is a big business. It's better done by big companies. Small companies come along and then make these chips and then they sell them off to big companies to then productize them and to bring them to the pipe and scale up. So that's kind of how it's going. And that seems to be yet another step down that line. So I think it's a good fit and going through the hoops, probably the last we see of it. We'll probably start talking about Marvell ASICs in about a year's time, 2 years' time, I imagine.
We'll see.
Because there's used to be, what was it? Not Xilogic. It was Cavium. I can't think of the name of the ASIC Cavium's got. Anyway, skip that.
Okay. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. As we noted, this was a short week this week. So, Greg, if folks want to get more from you, where can they find it?
This week, focusing on the Ignition membership system. That is where Packet Pushers has been producing members only. Today, we're still producing and filling out the content roster there, but I'm just producing a video, finalizing a video, which we'll publish next week on this campus thing where I talk for 20 minutes about how I think that happens while I'm drinking a beer, which gets the best out of me most often. So if you can pay to be a member, a premium member, you can get access to that video. It's $100 a year and it helps support us. So if you've been enjoying our content for the last 8 years, yes, we do monetize via sponsorships and ads, but this puts us in another place where we could keep the business going and provide you with some very unique non-aligned, we get to say the things that we want to say. So ignition.packetpushers.net.
And don't worry, we're still going to be producing our regular slate of podcasts for absolutely free, but we've got more content over at ignition.packetpushers.net, so go check it out. And as always, thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like it, tell your friends or give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes. That really helps. And again, check out our membership program. That's at ignition.packetpushers.net. Also, thanks to our sponsor, Interoptic. And of course, thanks to you for listening. And that is it.